The first day is over. The first day of the 3 days short course. Certainly 3 days is a very short period. But when you can't spare time for the 10-day course, it is good at least to join a 3-day course and make use of it as a refresher course. Moreover, in a 3-day course, you have better environment to work seriously, because in the normal 10-day courses there are nearly half of the students as new students, sometimes even more than half students are new students, and naturally because of that and old students has to face a lot of disturbances, inconveniences. But in a course like this, where there are only old students, matured old students, you have a better congenial atmosphere and you can work more seriously. And if you work seriously, quite possible that even in 3 days you may get the same benefit as you get by joining a 10-day course with the new students. And you are working seriously today, the whole day. You wear an anapana. Tomorrow morning you will start practicing vipassana, and the next 2 days you will work on vipassana. See that you make best use of these 3 days. Time is so precious, so precious. Let this be a real refresher course for you. Refresher course, so far as the practice is concerned. And refresher course also, so far as the theory of the technique is concerned. The discourse every evening will be to remind you the theory of the technique. Being old students, you know very well what you have come here for, what is this path, what is this technique. It is a process of truth realization, a process of self-realization. Every step that you take on the path is a step which helps you to realize the truth, the actual truth pertaining to yourself, within yourself. And as you continue to realize the truth pertaining to yourself at the experiential level, naturally and automatically, you start realizing the truth about the universe. You start realizing the law, the universal law. The universal law which governs the entire universe, animate, inanimate. You start realizing it at the experiential level within the framework of your body. And it becomes so clear to you that the entire path is universal. It is not sectarian. No dogma is involved. No cult is involved. No blind faith is involved. No blind belief of this philosophy or that philosophy is involved. No rites or rituals are involved. You just keep on accepting the fact, accepting the truth that you realize yourself. The entire technique, the entire path is not connected with any organized religion, not connected with any sect. Understand, it is not Buddhism. Certainly, this is the teaching of a Buddha, an enlightened person, but an enlightened person teaches universal truths. He is never interested in establishing a sect. He is never interested in an organized religion. Sectarianism, organized religions, are rather obstacles in the progress of the path of Dhamma. An organized religion is an organized religion, limited to a particular sect, a particular community. Buddhism is for Buddhists, just as Jainism is for Jains, Hinduism for Hindus, Christianity for Christians, Judaism for the Jews, Sikhism for the Sikhs, and so on. But the Dhamma, the law universal, is for one and all. This becomes clearer and clearer as one progresses on the path of self-realization, truth-realization. How one is governed by the law, the universal law, and how everyone is governed by the universal law. One may call oneself by this name or that name, it makes no difference. The law is law. Every step that you take on the path, you take it with a clear understanding that you are not getting yourself converted from one organized religion to another organized religion. You are getting yourself converted into Dhamma, the universal law, the universal truth. And that too with your own understanding, understanding with direct experience. Like you started your work, as you started in every course that you have taken, by taking precepts, being old students, you take 8 precepts. The last 3 precepts are to help you in your meditation. But the most important ones are the first 5 precepts. Initially, when someone joins a course like this, one accepts it because one has come to learn a particular technique of meditation in expectation of some peace or harmony within. And the teacher says that you have to take 5 precepts and you have to observe. So, all right, I take these 5 precepts and I observe. And it becomes easy also because it is only for the duration, the period of the course, and because of the situation, the atmosphere around the heavy program, it is quite easy to observe these precepts. So one accepts them and observes them. But very soon one starts realizing at the intellectual level as to why I am observing these precepts. The precepts are that I must abstain from killing, from stealing, from sexual misconduct, from speaking lies or harsh words, words of backbiting, useless words. I must abstain from taking any kind of intoxicant. That means I should abstain from doing anything at the physical and vocal level which will harm other beings. And at the intellectual level it becomes clear that if someone harms me, hurts me by a physical or verbal action, I feel so unhappy, so miserable. Similarly, if I take such an action towards another person, this person will also feel badly hurt, agitated, miserable. So I better abstain from doing this. Again, at the intellectual level, one starts understanding that after all, I am a human being. And a human being is a social being. One has to live in the society. One has to deal with other people. If I do anything at the physical or vocal level which disturbs the peace and harmony of other people, which hurts and harms other people, then I am disturbing the peace and harmony of the whole society. How can I experience peace and harmony when I have disturbed the peace and harmony of everyone around me? As a social being, it is my duty not to disturb the peace and harmony of others so that I can enjoy peace and harmony myself. Again, at the intellectual level, one starts thinking, well, certainly I must observe these precepts, the 5 silas, because if I break them, I break the rules, the law of the country, and the state, the administration, the government might take action against me. If I kill somebody, I'll be punished. If I steal something, I'll be punished. If I commit rape or adultery, I'll be punished. If I speak lies and deceive somebody, I'll be punished. If I get intoxicated and harm others, I'll be punished. So to save myself from such state punishments, certainly I must abstain from such unwholesome actions. Again at the intellectual level, or maybe at the devotional or emotional level, when someone says that when you break your precepts, you'll be unhappy now, and you'll be unhappy in your future lives as well. If you observe these precepts, you'll be happy now, and you'll be happy in your future lives as well. So with this understanding, one may abstain from breaking silas. But as one progresses on the path of Dhamma, that means as one progresses on the path of self-realization, truth-realization, realization of the universal law at the experiential level within one's own framework of the body, it becomes clearer and clearer that I have to observe these precepts because the nature will punish me. The nature will punish me here and now if I break any of these precepts. It becomes so clear that I cannot break any of these precepts unless I generate tremendous amount of negativity, defilement, impurity in my mind. Then only I perform unwholesome actions at the physical level or vocal level, which will disturb the peace and harmony of the atmosphere around me, which will harm and hurt other beings. For example, I can't kill anybody unless I generate tremendous amount of anger, hatred, ill will, animosity. I can't steal anything unless I generate greed in my mind. I cannot commit sexual misconduct unless I generate passion, lust in my mind. I cannot speak lie and try to deceive others unless I generate greed or ego or fear or any such defilement in the mind. I cannot take intoxicants unless I have a craving for the same. And with the experience, by practicing vipassana, one starts realizing that whenever I generate any defilement in the mind, anger, hatred, ill will, animosity, passion, fear, ego, any defilement, I become very agitated. I become very miserable. That means the nature does not want me to generate defilement in the mind. The nature starts punishing me as soon as I generate any defilement in the mind. And it also becomes very clear that this law of nature is not limited to a particular person or persons belonging to a particular sect or a particular community or particular organized religion or a particular country or a particular era. Anyone who generates negativity in the mind is punished by the nature then and there. This person is bound to become miserable. If one generates anger and calls oneself a Hindu, the nature will not favor this person. Because this person calls oneself a Hindu, and the nature starts favoring this person, and the nature does not give punishment to this person, and this person does not become agitated or unhappy or miserable by generating anger, then the law is favoring somebody. The law is not universal. But the fact is, the law is universal. When we keep on calling oneself as a Hindu, or a Buddhist, or a Christian, or a Jain, or a Muslim, or a Sikh, or a Jewish, makes no difference. As soon as one generates any negativity in the mind, one is bound to become miserable. This is universal law of nature. And again, by this practice, one starts realizing at the experiential level that when my mind is free from these negativities, when my mind gets purified from these defilements, and I start generating good qualities like love, compassion, goodwill for others, look, the nature starts rewarding me. Then and there, as soon as I generate love, compassion, goodwill, I start experiencing peace and harmony within myself. And this law is applicable to one and all. A Hindu may generate love, compassion, goodwill. A Muslim may do so. A Christian may do so. A Jewish may do so. A Buddhist may do so. It makes no difference. Anyone who purifies the mind and generates good qualities of love, compassion, goodwill, is bound to be rewarded, starts enjoying peace and harmony. Oh, this is law of nature. And this is what is called Dhamma. I am here to practice Dhamma, not any organized religion, not any sectarian teaching. The Dhamma, the law, which is universal. Oh, for this purpose, I have taken these five precepts. Initially, one feels that by observing these five precepts, I am not harming others. I am not disturbing the peace and harmony of the society. But as one progresses on the path, it becomes so clear that by observing these precepts, I am not obliging anybody. I am obliging myself. I have started helping myself. Because by breaking these precepts, I might harm others, I might not harm others, but certainly I harm myself. Because before breaking any sila, I generate negativity in the mind, I generate impurity in my mind, and the nature starts punishing me. And I don't want this punishment. Therefore, to keep myself free from the punishment of the nature, I observe these precepts. It becomes so clear. Every precept, when you break it, before you harmed others, you have started harming yourself. And the Dhamma is, the path of Dhamma is, the practice of Dhamma is not to harm others and not to harm yourself. Neither harm yourself nor harm others. At times, a new student, at times even a so-called old student who is not matured in Dhamma, comes and tells me, well, I understand that I should not break the first sila. To kill others is certainly not good for me, not good for others. I should not break the second sila. To steal something which does not belong to me is not wholesome. I harm myself, I harm others, I understand. The fourth sila, to speak lies or harsh words, I understand. This is unwholesome. I should not harm others, I should not harm myself. But the other two, I don't understand. Why you give so much emphasis to these? Sexual misconduct, when it goes to the stage of raping, I understand it is not good. But with the consent of two people, if there is adultery, what harm? I have not harmed anybody. And the nature has not punished me. I feel quite happy about it. What harm? A big illusion, a big delusion. You certainly started harming others. When you have such sexual misconduct with anybody, and if you are a married person, you harmed, disturbed the peace and harmony of your own spouse. And with other person is a married person, you disturbed the peace and harmony of the spouse of the other person. Even otherwise, you allowed yourself to generate tremendous amount of passion and lust in your mind, and you helped someone else also to generate lust and passion in the mind. And the law of nature is such that if you are to reach the higher stages of peace and harmony, if you are to reach the higher stages of full liberation from all the defilements, from all the miseries, you have to reach the stage where you start living naturally the life of celibacy. Otherwise, you are pouring petrol in the fire of passion. You are not coming out of it. One who really wants to come out of passion, one has to observe this precept. And then the question comes about this intoxication. Again, someone out of delusion comes and argues, I don't get intoxicated. I take just a small cup of wine. This does not intoxicate me. What harm? And I have not harmed anybody. And I feel quite happy with that. I have not harmed myself. Again, what a great delusion. Every drunkard, every alcoholic, every addict starts with a small cup of alcohol under the illusion that I will always keep myself free from high intoxication. And see how, step by step, one gets involved in high intoxication. Not only that, when one breaks this sila, the fifth sila, it becomes so easy for this person to break all the other four silas. It becomes so easy. There is a story here. That a lama was running out of his country, running from Tibet towards India in a great hurry. Very cold winter. Whole day he keeps on walking. Evening he finds some shelter somewhere and takes rest. One evening, he reached a small inn. The owner of the inn was a young Tibetan lady. He was very tired. He tried to sleep somewhere under the roof. This Tibetan young lady got attracted towards this young lama and told her, "It's so cold outside. Why don't you come and take rest in my room? Sleep in my room." The lama was annoyed. "What are you talking? I'm a lama. I'm a monk. How can I sleep with you in your room? I live the life of celibacy. Never speak such words to a lama." She said, "Yes, all right. But then I find you so exhausted. I want to help you. I feel pity for you. I want to prepare a very good food for you. You are so exhausted. Take some good food and then sleep. Doesn't matter, you sleep outside. But I can't prepare very good food for you. I need some good meat. And look, here is my old yak. I can't kill this yak. Here is the sword. You kill this yak, and I will take some flesh from it, some meat from it. I'll prepare very good food for you." Again the lama said, "Mad woman, what are you talking? I'm a lama. I'm a monk. How can I kill?" "I'm sorry, sir. But how can I prepare good food for you? This yak is so big, and I can't kill." "All right. There, little far away, there is a hut, and a very old Tibetan lady is living there. She has got some very young yaks, yaklings, calves. Take this rope, tie one of the yak, and bring it here, and I will kill. I can kill a young yak, but not such an old yak, such a big yak." And again the lama said, "What you are talking? How can I steal? But then how can I prepare food for you? All right, if you don't steal, then you go and say to this old lady that I am taking your yak for a walk outside. I will walk with this yak. A few minutes, I'll be happy, the yak will be happy, then I'll bring it back. And you bring this yak to me, then I will kill." "What you are talking? How to speak lie? How to deceive others? How is it possible?" The young lady found it impossible how to entice this fellow. So she said, "All right, don't do anything. But look, you are so tired, you are so exhausted. Come sit. Have a little drink. This will make you fresh. And you can get a sound sleep." The lama was really exhausted, tired after a long journey, and he took just a small cup of the alcohol that was given, and this one cup made him take the second cup, the third cup. He got intoxicated and did everything that that woman wanted him to do. You break the fifth Shila and you can break every Shila. You'll break every Shila easily. So to keep yourself away from breaking any of the Shila, it is absolutely essential that you don't break the fifth Shila. As the student becomes more and more matured, the student starts understanding the value of precepts, sila. It is so important for my progress on the path of Dhamma. So you took your five precepts and you started working? What you started working? You started observing your respiration. The first step of the technique of meditation. After taking precepts, the first step of the technique of meditation, you started observing your respiration. Again, it becomes so clear to the traveler on the path of Dhamma that although I understand very well that I should not break any of my sila, yet I find that I cannot abstain from breaking silas. And the reason for this is that I have got no mastery over my mind. I have no control over my mind. I know perfectly well that I should not drink, I should not speak lies, I should not kill, I should not do this, I should not do that. But then because I have no control over my mind, I commit things which I should not commit. So I must have control over my mind. That is why this second division of Dhamma, Samadhi, concentration of the mind, mastery over the mind. An old student again starts understanding very well that I can develop mastery over my mind, I can develop concentration of my mind by using any object. There are many objects with the help of which I can train my mind to get concentrated. Then why I have chosen this object, my own respiration, the natural respiration as it comes in, as it goes out? Again, it becomes so clear that any other object would have taken him towards a sectarian path. But this object of natural breath is an object of universal path. The breath is breath. You are observing natural breath. Say, for example, you could have used the name of a particular god or goddess, founder of this religion or that religion, and repeating this name again and again, again and again, you would have certainly concentrated your mind. Similarly, you started imagining the shape, the form of a particular god or goddess or founder of this religion or that religion. Certainly, you would have been able to concentrate your mind. But then that path would not have been a path universal. It would have been a sectarian path. A god or goddess of this particular sect will be acceptable to the members of this particular sect, not to the members of other sects. The shape, the form of a particular god of a particular sect will be acceptable to the members of that particular sect, not to the members of other sect. It can't be universal. But just observing the natural breath, it has nothing to do with any sectarian belief. The breath is breath. It can neither be Hindu or a Muslim or a Christian or a Jain or a Buddhist. Breath is breath. And you are just observing it. A Hindu can very well observe the breath. A Muslim can very well observe the breath. A Christian, a Jewish, anyone can observe the breath, without getting oneself converted from one organized religion to another organized religion. This is what an enlightened person teaches, a universal path which can be practiced by one and all. Oh, that is why I have chosen the object of my concentration, of my awareness, my own respiration, natural respiration. And again it becomes very clear to the meditator, why natural respiration? Why not artificial respiration? Why not controlled breathing? Why not regulated breathing? When you work with controlled breathing, with regulated breathing, then you are not observing the truth as it is. It's a created truth, an artificial truth. And the technique, the path is that you observe the natural truth as it manifests itself from time to time, from moment to moment. If the breath is deep at this moment, you are just aware it is deep. If it is shallow at this moment, you are just aware it is shallow. You are doing nothing. If it passes through the left nostril, you are just aware passing through the left nostril. If it passes through the right nostril, you are just aware passing through the right nostril. That's all. You never try to change. You just observe. You let the nature play its own role and you just observe the nature as it is, the truth as it is. An old student also starts understanding very well that as I start observing my natural breath, it becomes so clear to me that my breath is strongly related to my mind also. It is not merely a physical activity. It has got so much to do with my mind. And it is strongly related to the mental defilements. It becomes so clear. By observing the respiration, one finds that suddenly the mind is getting involved in some kind of defilement. Because of some memory of the past, anger has started arising. A negativity has started arising. And the breath loses its normality. It is no more normal. So long as there is anger in the mind, or hatred in the mind, or passion in the mind, or fear in the mind, the breath is never normal. It becomes little hard, it becomes little fast. And the meditator observes that as and when this defilement passes away, the mind is free from defilement, the breath again becomes normal. So it becomes so clear at the experiential level that my breath is strongly related to my mind and very strongly related to the defilements of my mind. I am observing breath without using any word or name, without imagining any form or shape, because the ultimate aim of my meditation is not just to concentrate my mind. Concentration of the mind is good, it is helpful, it is a tool, it is an aid, but the final goal is purification of the mind. So long as there is impurity in the mind, I am bound to suffer. I am bound to become miserable from time to time because one impurity or the other which is stored inside will raise its head and I will become agitated. So I have to clear this stock. I have to come out of the habit of generating defilements in the mind. So purity of the mind is the final goal for me. Observing breath, bare breath. By observing bare breath, I am not only developing concentration of my mind, but I have started purifying my mind. One starts realizing this very easily. As and when I am observing the natural breath coming in, going out, I am free from illusion, I am free from delusion because I am with the truth, the reality, however gross it may be, but the fact is that at this moment I am breathing in, I am breathing out. And I am just accepting this fact. And while I am observing the breath coming in, going out, I don't generate any craving. I don't start craving for a breath. I don't generate any aversion. I don't start hating my breath. I just observe the breath as it is. If it is deep, it is deep. If it is shallow, it is shallow. If it passes to the left nostril, right nostril, right nostril. I'm just observing. Mere observation. Free from illusion, delusion. Free from craving, aversion. Although I get very few moments like this, Most of the time the mind keeps on dwelling in the past, keeps on dwelling in the future. I forget all about my respiration. But those moments when I am with respiration, nothing but respiration, I am free from these defilements. Maybe just at the surface level of the mind, but I am free from these defilements. The process of purification has started. It becomes clear that with the help of my respiration, I am not only developing my faculty of concentrating the mind, but I have also started purifying my mind. It becomes so clear, it is so universal. Anyone who starts observing the breath, as it is, starts not only concentrating the mind, but starts purifying the mind. One may call oneself a Hindu or a Muslim or a Christian or a Jain or a Jewish, makes no difference. One may be Indian or a Burmese or an American or a Russian, makes no difference. Anyone who practices will get the same benefit. Oh. Certainly I am walking on a universal path. I am not getting myself involved in any organized religion. It becomes clearer and clearer. Sila, one finds universal. Samadhi, one finds universal. And then the third step, which you will start practicing tomorrow morning, when you start practicing Vipassana, the Panya, the wisdom, the field of wisdom. Again, the field of wisdom becomes so clear. Oh, universal. Again, this law of nature. So long as Panya is Sutta Panya, you heard about the truth, you read about the truth, and you are accepting it because you got great confidence in someone who has said about this truth, and you are accepting it. This is Sutta Panya. You take the next step, Chintan Panya. You use your intellect. You try to rationalize whatever you read or whatever you heard. But this is not enough for this path. Mere Sut Panya, mere Chintan Panya is not sufficient. They are helpful. They give you inspiration, they give you guidance. But the actual benefit that you get, being old student, you know very well, the actual benefit that you get is by Bhavanamaya Panya. The Panya, the wisdom, the insight that you develop with direct experience of your own. The Sutta Panya, the Chinta Panya gave you inspiration, gave you guidance. In that respect, they were very good. But the real benefit that you started getting was from the Bhavanamaya Panya. And what is Bhavanamaya Panya? When it is mere Sutamaya Panya, then you may accept it because you belong to a particular sect and the founder of the sect has said that this is true. You accept because you have got great faith in the founder of this particular sect. Or a particular scripture says so and you have got great faith in this scripture and you accept it. Others may accept, may not accept. It can't be universal. Not necessarily that it must be universal. So also Chintamaya Panya, you intellectualized it, and most of the time when you start intellectualizing a fact which you read from your own scriptures of your own sect, all your intellect is used to justify it. All your intellect is used to rationalize it. It can't be universal. Others may not rationalize it. Others may not accept it as a very rational thing. And after all, intellect is intellect. It has got its own limitation. Therefore, it can't be universal. The sphere of intellect cannot be the same of every person. It can't be universal. But when you start experiencing the truth, and you accept only that much truth which you experience yourself, then you are free from sectarian beliefs. You are free from devotional or emotional beliefs, even free from intellectual games. Now you are accepting what you are experiencing. And of course you experience initially gross realities, doesn't matter. But you keep on observing these gross realities that you experience directly, and you keep on observing them objectively, without reacting to them. Then you find how you started moving from gross towards subtle, from subtle to subtlest. You start experiencing the subtlest reality pertaining to your own physical structure. You start experiencing subtlest reality pertaining to your own mind and the mental contents. And that helps you to understand the law of nature. Look how this mind-matter phenomena is so interrelated, influencing one another. How something arises in the mind and it starts manifesting itself as a sensation on the body. As an old student, it becomes so clear to you. An emotion arises in the mind and you get a sensation on the body. An anger has arisen and you find there is heat throughout the body. Palpitation has become strong, there is tension. Similarly, any other defilement will result in some biochemical reaction or the other in the body. And this happens with everyone. It is not limited only to Buddhists or Hindus or Jains or Christians or Muslims. This is law of nature. And you are observing this law of nature. When you take your first step in the field of Panya, which you are going to take tomorrow, again repeating it, you start observing sensations throughout the body. Even today, while you are observing your respiration, you started observing the sensation on the area below the nostrils, above the upper lip. Tomorrow you will feel this sensation throughout the body. Sensation of this type or that type makes no difference. Any sensation. You are training your mind not to react to these sensations, but to observe them objectively. And then you start realizing the truth, the law, the nature, that whatever the sensation may be, gross or subtle, pleasant or unpleasant, whatever the sensation may be, it has the same characteristic. The characteristic of arising, passing away. Arising, passing away. Now this is your direct experience, not because your teacher says so, not because someone else has said so, or a scripture says so. Your own experience says that every sensation arises, sooner or later it passes away. When it is a gross, solidified, intensified sensation, it seems to stay for some time, but ultimately it passes away. And when it turns into subtle sensation, a vibration, a wavelet, then you find how it arises, passes, with great rapidity. It arises, passes. Oh, the characteristic remains the same. Anicca, anicca, anicca. Then this anicca is not a philosophical belief for you. Not because a particular sect is accepting this belief, so you also accept it. Nothing doing. This is universal law. The entire field of mind and matter is constantly changing, arising, passing. And something which is constantly arising, passing, and you start identifying yourself with this ephemeral reality, constantly changing, you start developing attachment towards it, it results in misery for you. This you understand by your own experience. Dukkha, dukkha. Again, not because of philosophy of a particular sect. This is the reality, the truth. Anyone who develops attachment towards this changing phenomenon is bound to become miserable. Then it is not I. Look, certainly it is not I. This is not mine. This is not my soul, because I have no control over it. I have no mastery over it. Things are happening in their own way. I can't control them. No I, no mine, not my soul. The entire physical structure, the entire mental structure, the combination of the two is not I, not mine, not my soul. Anatta, anatta, egolessness, substancelessness, a senselessness. Again, this is not a philosophy of a particular sect. This is reality which you started experiencing. And experiencing this reality of anicca, dukkha and anatta, you find you started changing the habit pattern of your mind. Deep inside, the habit pattern of the mind has been to react to this mind matter phenomena, which keeps on manifesting itself as this sensation or that sensation. You feel a pleasant sensation, you start reacting with craving and clinging. You feel unpleasant sensation, you start reacting with aversion and hatred. Now you are coming out of this behavior pattern. Whatever you experience, pleasant, unpleasant or neutral, you keep on understanding this is anicca, this is anicca, this is anicca, changing, changing, changing. So you neither generate craving nor generate aversion. And there is no illusion, no delusion, because you are with the reality, the truth, the law, the nature. Although most of the time, because of the old habit pattern, you keep on reacting, you keep on generating defilements, but you certainly get few moments when you are free from defilements. And those few moments are wonderful moments. They become few seconds, they become few minutes. And like this you keep on developing your wisdom, your own insight. At the experiential level, you start purifying your mind because you start changing the habit pattern of your mind. It becomes so clear to a traveler of the path of Dhamma that the entire path, the path of Sila, the path of Samadhi, the path of Panya, is so universal, so universal. It has nothing to do with this sect or that sect, this organized religion or that organized religion. I am not binding myself with this particular organized religion. I bind myself with the law of nature, universal law of nature. I understand the universal law of nature and I start living a life in line with this law of nature so that I come out of misery, I come out of suffering. A life which is good for me, which is peaceful and harmonious for me, and also which is good for others. A life which helps me to generate peace and harmony for others too. With this understanding, one keeps on progressing on the path of Dhamma. The next 2 days, get yourself more and more established on the path of Dhamma. See that you make best use of the remaining 2 days. Every moment is so precious. Therefore, maintain continuity of practice. Today, you are working on Anapana. Tonight, till you get deep sleep, you will be working on Anapana. But tomorrow, when you get Vipassana, then after getting Vipassana, you have to keep on working with the sensation on the body, day and night. Only when you are in deep sleep or when you are listening to these discourses. Otherwise, all the time you are aware of respiration while you are on Anapana, or you are aware of sensation while you are on Vipassana. Like this you make best use of the time. Make best use of the opportunity. Make best use of whatever facility you got here. And make best use of this wonderful Dhamma, the universal Dhamma, the wonderful technique. For your own good, for your own benefit, for your own liberation. Liberation from the bondages, the shackles, the chains of craving, aversion, illusion, delusion, so that you can enjoy real peace. real harmony, real happiness. May all of you enjoy real peace, real harmony, real happiness, real happiness. Svat sav mangalam bhavat sav mangalam bhavat. Take rest for about 5 minutes and then we start again. Take rest for about 5 minutes.